I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jan Shipps, who's a Professor Emerita of History and Religious Studies at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. She is an American historian specializing in Mormon history, particularly in the latter half of the 20th century to the present. Shipps is generally regarded as the foremost non-Mormon scholar of the Latter-day Saints movement, having studied the Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints for decades. Her first book on the subject was Mormonism, The Story of a New Religious Tradition, and her latest book is Sojourner in the Promised Land, 40 Years Amongst the Mormons, in which she interweaves her own history of Mormon watching with 16 essays on Mormon history and culture. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jan Shipps.
I'm happy to be here.
And I recently spoke with a law professor who had real concerns, First Amendment concerns, about Mitt Romney's connections to the Mormon Church and its hierarchy. And he was arguing that because Mitt Romney is a bishop or even a stake president, he used the analogy of the Catholic Church, saying that that would be the equivalent of a bishop who would be reporting to Rome. And in this case, in Romney's case, a President Romney would be reporting to the Pope in the Mormon Pope in Salt Lake City and his College of Cardinals.
Oh, no, that is a mistake. A bishop in the Mormon Church, it's called a bishop because they were called bishops in the New Testament, but it's really being a pastor. And it's being a volunteer pastor, and being the president of a stake is it still a volunteer activity, and it is oversight to the he has oversight of several wards, a stake president does, but this is again a volunteer position. He is not and has never been what you call a general authority. A general authority is someone whose position makes him, and it's always a him because it always has to be a member of the priesthood, but they have, you know, it's priesthood of everybody. They have, those that are called general authorities, have responsibility for the whole church as opposed to a local area, and they do not answer the way they answer to the College of Cardinals, which would be the Council of the Twelve in the Mormon Church. They do not answer at that level.
And the prophet is the head of the church, right?
The prophet is the head of the church, and he has two counselors. Mm-hmm. So there are 15 people that would be parallel or something like the College of Cardinals, but this was not a position that had to report to the Council of the Twelve.
So, Jan Shipps, obviously we're having this conversation because Mitt Romney is likely to win substantially in Florida, and I think by most counts, this is the presumptive nominee. And in terms of his statements about separation of church and state, Jack Kennedy, before he became president, made a famous speech in which he reiterated his support for the First Amendment. And as you know, back then there was some anti-Catholic bigotry which he addressed. And what's curious about Romney is that there's been very, very palpable anti-Mormon bigotry amongst the evangelical wing, particularly in the red states, if you will. And his only statement on the matter of the First Amendment and his Mormonism, he basically was critical of the growth of secularism in this country and didn't take the same opportunity that Jack Kennedy took. I was puzzled by that. What was your response?
I was surprised when he gave the speech.
When he ran last time, yeah.
When he ran last time, 08,
right.
In the 08 campaign, at the speech where he did not have anything to say about people who were what they call nuns, people who do not have a connection to the church or people who regard themselves as more spiritual than religious. But I think that he didn't have the same realization that the attitude toward the Catholics had been so clear for so long. And I think that maybe Romney wasn't as aware of the need to reassure people that he would not have to answer to the Council of the Twelve.
Recently, he basically took the position that's popular amongst the religious right, and that is that there's a problem with creeping secularism and that there's a kind of anti-Christian bias amongst the liberal elite. Rather than take on the anti-Mormon bigotry that exists in amongst evangelical Christians, he was trying to co-opt them or win them over or
something. Now,
yeah.
The fact is that the evangelicals, this is the attitude that Mormonism is not Christian on the part of the evangelicals, is really actually a post-World War II position that they have held and so strongly. And I think, at least in where I wrote about is Mormonism Christian, I think this is they were trying to till the same fields. They were making converts in the new suburbs of and the developments, the housing developments in the suburbs, and they had the same group of people that they were reaching. And so the attitude that Mormonism is not Christian that was spelled out and was made such a big issue in the evangelical churches, in some ways, was the evangelicals needed something to be against because they were not all in one church. There were lots of different kinds of evangelicals.
Sure. Well, it is the fastest growing church, I believe, in Mormonism, isn't it, in the country?
Well, if you want to talk about a single institution, you can say that Mormonism, since the Second World War, has grown very, very, very rapidly. But it has not grown as rapidly as, say, the Pentecostals and the Evangelicals. But the Pentecostals and the Evangelicals are not in one institution.
I see. But I think it is true, is it not, Jan Shipps, that the Mormon Church, on a per capita basis, is one of the wealthiest churches.
They do not make public their wealth, but most people believe that this is the case. But their wealth is in buildings and all sorts of, all over the world, they have used so much of their wealth to build temples all over the world and build chapels all over the world, where it was so expensive to do it.
Jan Shipps, again, one of the country's leading, actually foremost non-Mormon scholars of the Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints. We're talking about Mitt Romney's, now that he's the presumptive nominee for the Republicans, his ties to the Mormon Church and the possible influence the Church would have over him as a president, which has been overstated as we started out discussing. However, there is some secrecy, which I suppose leads to suspicion and charges of cult-like behaviors. I don't know that anybody, a non-Mormon, cannot see go into a service. That's what I understand.
Oh no, this is complicated by the fact that there are two kinds of Mormon structures. One is usually called a chapel. Some people call it a church, and it's where they meet on Sunday, where they have meetings all during the week and so forth, except on Monday nights, which is family home evening. And that is public, and anyone in the United States can go in and attend those services. The Mormon temple is understood more like a ancient Hebrew temple, and there are ordinances that are regarded as extremely sacred, and they are therefore private. People like to say secret, but it's really more private. Not all Mormons can even go into Mormon temples because you must have a bishop, that is your pastor's, recommend that says that your faith is strong, and you must have paid your tithing in order to go into Mormon temples.
It's often been described as a very patriarchal religion. Is that the case?
It is a patriarchal and a hierarchical system, as the institution operates from the top down. But at the local level, the hierarchy doesn't work quite as strictly as it does at the, you know, from the institution. When you look at an institution, how does the institution operate? And then you look at the local, and the local is much more open to people that are might not hold particularly high positions in the church or anything. The idea is that each ward should only be big enough that everyone has a chance to serve. Everyone has a calling. And when the wards get too big, they divide them.
So let's talk a bit about their political influence. They're disproportionately, I think, in terms of the size of the religion, has considerable representation in the United States Senate. There are five Mormon senators, including Harry Reid, the head of the Senate. But they've taken a very, very conservative stance in politics. They essentially scuttled the Equal Rights Amendment, and they've taken it here in California. They funded Proposition 8, against gay marriage, etc., which is being overturned. So what is their relationship to politics, and how much does the tithing come in? Are they in a position to put money behind their conservative beliefs?
Well, yes and no. They don't put a lot of tithing money to support their positions. They ask for gifts from the membership to support their positions, or at least that's what happened in with regard to Proposition 8. And they did encourage, that is, encourage in the sense of suggesting that women not vote for the Equal Rights Amendment. The church came out against it. It's very rare that the church takes a really strong position on anything except things that they believe would hurt the family. And they were convinced, I think wrongly, that the Equal Rights Amendment would undercut the family.
Well, it seems like undercut the patriarchy. I mean, but that...
But they thought it would undercut the family itself. Mm-hmm. Mormonism is a family-oriented faith.
Well, now, its roots, I understand, you know, first of all, its roots are sort of like a lot of some religions have somewhat bizarre theological beginnings, and that's...
Let me say it this way. Mormonism started out as a cult, but so did Christianity. But when you can't tell a cult from the culture, it's no longer a cult. And that was true of Christianity, and it's true of Mormonism.
But it's in its early days, it met with a lot of hostility and moved from New York, I think, to Missouri, where, again, there were a lot of violence and prejudice against them, and they finally made their long trek to Salt Lake City. This may account for some of its sense of exclusion, if you will, because of the hostility towards it. But my understanding is that the polygamy was largely a result of the large number of widows. Is that true?
No, I don't think so. At least my interpretation is that the Mormon prophet Joseph Smith was very, very concerned with the Old Testament as well as the New Testament. And he talked first about the restoration of the Church of Jesus Christ, and then he talked about the restoration of Israel, that is, that everyone in the church was understood to be a part of the tribes of Israel, one of the tribes of Israel. They had, when they would get their patriarchal blessings, it would tell them which tribe and so forth. But then there is a third layer not just the Church of Jesus Christ and not just the restoration of Israel, but the restoration of the ancient order of things, which is a part of the third layer of Mormon theology. And I'm convinced that the prophet was more concerned to bring back the ancient order of things, and that he saw that Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Joseph and, you know, Solomon and David and so forth all had multiple wives. And that was a part of the ancient order of things. The notion that there were just too many women is wrong, in the sense that it was announced in 1852, and at that time, and it was publicly announced in 1852, but when they first went to the Great Basin, there were more men than women.
So, but there was a long history of hostility towards the United States. It was the last, apart from Hawaii, it was the last state to join the Union because they did not want federal jurisdiction. I think the U.S. Army was sent, I think at least on one occasion, to try and subdue them.
This is wrong to say they didn't want. They wanted to become a state. They tried to become a state in 1852. They tried to, at the time of the Missouri Compromise, they tried to become a state, but the Missouri Compromise meant that they couldn't, even though they had enough people out there to become a state. They wanted to become a state. They tried again and again. So that the notion that they did not want federal jurisdiction is something of a mistake, because they tried very hard to become a state and finally managed to do so, but only after they gave up polygamy and after the practice of polygamy. They didn't give up the belief in it. They just gave up the practice. And only after they divided their parties, instead of having one single people's party, which was the Mormon Party, they had to divide into Republican and Democrat.
So Jan Shipps, again, American historian, is considered the foremost non-Mormon scholar of the Church of the Latter-day Saints. I understood that after the Mountain Meadow Massacre that took place, where a wagon train of settlers from Arkansas on their way to California, I think, were massacred by Mormons, and at the time a huge national furor, and that the federal courts were having a hard time getting any jurisdiction to put anybody on trial.
Well, the problem was that when they made Utah a territory, they took the leaders of the church, made the leader of the church, Brigham Young, the governor and the Indian agent, and except for the judges, they had all Mormons as the people who were in charge, were in the civil authorities in the state. So it was, for a while, a theocracy, clearly a theocracy. But the Mormon War that started before the Mountain Meadows Massacre was when Buchanan decided to send federal troops out to establish a non-Mormon as governor. And that was already on its way, and the people who were... I mean, I've done a big study of the Mountain Meadows Massacre, and the people who were there were afraid that the army was coming, and they were told that the people in the wagon train said they were going to California and bring back people to destroy the Mormons. These were people who had suffered persecution in Kirtland, Ohio, and Missouri, and Illinois. And a lot of these people that were involved in the massacre were people that had been persecuted for a long time. And it was that they just said no more. I don't know. It's a very complicated story.
Well, suffice to say that the President of the United States, Buchanan, he was considered, I think the, I think he's still considered by historians the worst president in the history of the United States. And some suggest that maybe George W. Bush might be joining him, but that's another discussion. But just to touch on you mentioned that they had to give up polygamy in order to become a part of the United States. Interesting enough, of course, Mitt Romney's great-grandfather left the United States because he was a polygamist.
That's right. And they went to Mexico.
Yeah, Miles Park Romney, the patriarch. He had four wives, took four wives with him and picked up another one. But interesting enough, that the compound where they lived is still operating today, with a lot of Mitt Romney's cousins are there, including Mike Romney, who's gone a little bit public in some emails and stuff, and it bears a striking resemblance. That colony down in Mexico still does it still practice polygamy?
I'm not sure whether it does or not, but we do know that there are lots of Mormons who believe that God wouldn't change his mind, and that they believe it was a mistake to give up polygamy, so that you have a lot of modern polygamy.
Well, just in closing, Jan Shipps, you've said you studied it for 50 years. What is fascinating about this religion is, of course, it is a truly an American homegrown religion. I believe it believes that Jesus Christ came to the United States, or what was the United States?
They believe that Jesus came to the Western Hemisphere.
Right.
And that he appeared to the people who had come here, who had left the Near East, the Jews that had left the Near East and come to America, come to the Western Hemisphere, about just before the beginnings of the Babylonian captivity. So this would have been the kind of, the prophet was really interested in what the Hebrew religion was before the Babylonian captivity.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Jan Shipps.
Well, it was a pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Jan Shipps, who's Professor Emerita of History and Religious Studies at Indiana University, Purdue University, Indianapolis. She is an American historian specializing in Mormon history, particularly in the latter half of the 20th century to the present, and she's generally regarded as the foremost non-Mormon scholar of the Latter-day Saints movement, having studied the Church of Jesus Christ of the Latter-day Saints for 50 years. Her first book on the subject was Mormonism, The Story of a New Religion Tradition, and her latest book is Sojourner in the Promised Land, 40 Years Amongst the Mormons. And that was a program that we recorded yesterday, but we're unable to play because of the breaking news from the Florida primaries. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Standing along the side of the pickup truck, a shot rang out in the night, just when everything seemed right, another headline written down in America. The guy that lived next door in 305.